Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 6 of Season 10 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast where we hijack our way through the 1974 classic thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me this week, at least hopefully all week, but at least today, is Stephen J. Rubin, a film historian, screenwriter, producer, author, and a podcaster. Welcome back to the show for yet another season, Steve.
Thanks, Rob. It's always a pleasure. I've done The Great Escape for you. I've done Saving Private Ryan, two of my all-time favorites. And now we're doing another one of my all-time favorites, The Taking of Pelham 123. It's a true delight to be here. I just wish we had the sound of subway cars in the background. That would make it even more appropriate.
Well, people can't see what you have behind you, but you actually have as the background, you know, on the Zoom, the poster or one of the posters of the film. So, you know, you got that there. That's good. That's important.
Absolutely. just for atmosphere's sake.
Yes. Okay. So why don't you first start off by telling everyone, what's your background with this movie? And, you know, do you remember the first time you saw it? Do you remember who you saw it with? Do you remember how often do you watch it? All these little tidbits.
Well, I want to say I saw it in the movies, but I'm not 100% sure I went to the theater to see it. Although the 1970s was a big movie-going time for me. Of course, this was the time of Jaws and The Godfather and Star Wars. Of course, as some of your listeners know, I've written 6 books on the James Bond movies, including 4 editions of the complete James Bond movie encyclopedia. The 70s was the era of Roger Moore and the Bonds, so I was going to the movies a lot. It's funny to be saying that I was going to the movies at a time when people over 40 are not going to the movies. We're not going to the movies Correct. Like we did. The under 40s, the young people who've embraced the Marvel Universe and all these science fiction movies, they still go. But in those days, we went to the movies. And I want to say I did see this in the theater. I just don't remember who I went with. But, you know, when they started introducing VHSs followed by DVDs and then Blu-rays, obviously, this is one of the titles I wanted to jump on. And when it's playing in the streaming verse or the cable verse or whatever you call it, and I'm looking for something to watch and I see The Taking of Pelham 123, 1974, by the way, not 2009. I'm not a big fan of the remake.
And definitely not. Did you ever see the one from the TV remake from 1998?
I never saw that. I actually did not know it existed until today when I saw it in IMDb's trivia file. But this movie...
You're not missing anything, don't worry.
Okay. Very good. Well, this movie, the 1974 Joseph Sargent directed Peter Stone screenplay of The Taking of Pelham 123, is certainly one of my favorite thrillers of all time. The filmmaking style, the performances, the range of the cast, it's just off the charts. And even though I've seen it so many times and I know how it ends, I still get gripped by it every time I watch it. I mean, it's just done in such a, I don't even know if you'd call it a documentary type style. I don't want to say it's anything like a documentary, but the way they present the hijacking and the police response and the transit authority response is done with a very deliberate, this is the way it goes approach. And I enjoyed that very much.
Okay. Very cool. So you said that you didn't like the 2009 version or that it's just not as good.
Well, I think that as in general, remakes are terrible.
Yes.
You could probably place on one hand the number of great remakes in the history. There's probably been 1,000 remakes and there have been less than 5 great ones. I often wonder why remake something that's so good originally. I can understand remaking a movie that just was terrible the first time out. But when you take on a classic like The Taking of Pelham 123, there's no way you can equate that. It's just not going to happen, even though obviously Denzel Washington and John Travolta are two of our best actors. They're always fun to watch. Denzel's done a number of remakes. He also did The Equalizer.
Yeah, that was a TV jump to jump.
And then he did let's see, he did another one, The Manchurian Candidate, which is another example of a movie that the original is so good, and why they thought of doing another one, I have no idea, and it paled in comparison. You know, it's so difficult to get a movie made these days. I'm out there every day trying to sell films ideas and film scripts, etc. And there seems to be a tendency in Hollywood to go for pre-marketed material, whether it's a reboot, a remake, a prequel, a sequel, a big intellectual property franchise like a Barbie. Originality is not necessarily embraced, which seems absolutely ridiculous. But if you look at the film slates every year now, particularly for the studios, everything is pre-marketed. So the idea of doing remakes of
classics. So is it name recognition? You think that they do it from that perspective?
Oh, absolutely. It's name recognition. It's marketing departments not wanting to do any heavy lifting right now. Nobody wants to start from scratch. And I think that that may make it an easier marketing issue, but it kind of presents the audience with the same movie every time. Now, every Marvel movie is different. I get that. But a lot of them seem very much leading in the same direction. I mean, Earth has to be protected. It cannot be destroyed. And after they've done that 100 times, I wonder, really? Is that all we can do now, story-wise?
Right.
So I you know, you're looking at somebody or you're listening to somebody who's out there trying to sell originality every day, and it's challenging. It's very challenging, but I'm not giving up. In the meantime, we can sit back and we can revel in great cinema, and this is certainly an example.
Yeah, for sure. Again, I completely agree with you with the whole idea of remakes. There are just a handful that you basically say to yourself, okay, it's worth going to see because they've matched or even possibly slightly surpassed, you know, the original. But those are rare.
The one that people often refer to as being the best is John Carpenter's The Thing, which reimagined the original Howard Hawks movie. And I liked The Thing remake. It wasn't, for me, the greatest thing since sliced bread, but it's very highly regarded. And there's a few others. I mean, the TV to film version of The Fugitive with Harrison Ford instead of David Janssen is just terrific. And it's an outlier. It's not a typical remake or reboot.
Correct. Yeah, no, one of the ones that I always think of I don't know if you've seen the 1998 version of 12 Angry Men with Jack Lemmon.
Well, not only did I see it.
1997.
Not only did I see it, I worked on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
There you go.
I was working for Showtime. I was in charge of unit publicity at that time. So I was on that set every day. One of the most fun experiences I've ever had. It's ironic you should mention that because my podcast topic tonight on my show, Stephen J. Rubin, Saturday Night at the Movies, is 12 Angry Men.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're doing my friend Stan Rosenfield, who I used to work for. He's a prominent publicist in L.A., and he and I are going to go over that movie from head to toe. Yeah, the 97 remake was a lot of fun. It's so funny. I working on that set every day, I found myself sitting on a couch with Jack Lemmon on my right, George C. Scott on my left. It doesn't get any better than that. And then I brought the Today Show out to do interviews. And James Gandolfini, as you recall, Tony Soprano, mm-hmm. everybody, yeah, was course. Virtually unknown at that time. And he kept on saying, Steve, why do they want to interview him? Interview me? I'm a nobody. I said, James, they're interviewing everybody in the cast. So, little did they know.
Yeah. No, I mean, that remake has such an amazing cast. It's unbelievable how whoever did the casting just bullseye with every single one of the because with one of the 12 they're even more recognizable than some of the ones from the original 12 Angry Men for people nowadays. Obviously, contemporarily when that came out in 57, people were able to recognize the actors more, but
Well,
it
you'll laugh because one of my original comedy projects I'm out there trying to sell at this moment is a spoof homage to 12 Angry Men. We have a script called 12 Anxious Men, and it's about the most dysfunctional jury in history. Two of the jurors are conjoined, and it's that kind of crazy. It's kind of Monty Python meets 12 Angry Men, and it's a lot of fun. The reason we wrote this is because logistically it's the easiest film to shoot because 99% of the movie takes place in one room, the jury room.
That's right.
Kind of like taking a Pelham 1-2-3 until they go outside and have to deal with the police response. The whole movie takes place in a subway car.
Yeah, I mean there's just stuff that takes place in the control room and a little bit in Garber, but they're all claustrophobic areas until they finally see the light of day type of thing. You're right.
Exactly. I was reading up on the making of the movie, and I found it interesting that the New York Transit Authority did not want to cooperate with the movie at first because they were fearful that criminals would get the wrong idea. But eventually, I guess John Lindsay, the mayor, stepped in, and they were given permission to shoot a subway car on a non-active line. So all those shots in that tunnel where the hijackers are have established themselves was on a non-running line.
Right. Okay, that makes sense, obviously. Especially, if you want to get all this filming done, you need to make sure that you're doing it. You don't have to be limited to only be doing it between 2 and 4 a.m. or whatever it is, because you want to make sure there are less trains running or
But
something.
apparently it was not a comfortable shoot for the crew. They were like coal miners. They would get off work and they were covered with the grime of working in a subway tunnel. And there was a lot of foul air and particulates and clamminess. And it didn't sound like it was fun to be sh shooting there.
Yeah, but the end result is worth it for us at least.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
We that isn't that why actors suffer so that we can actually enjoy watching their performances of what they do? Isn't that the way it works?
That's kind of it. I immediately remember reading about Charlton Heston rowing the oar in Ben-Hur, and after 56 takes of William Wyler, he felt like he had been rowing that oar forever.
Well, it's good for the biceps, I guess.
Good for the biceps. Spoofed beautifully, by the way, in one of my favorite movies, which maybe you'll do someday, The Three Stooges Meet Hercules.
Yeah, I don't think I'm ever going to be doing that. The fact that you mention it means that I might want to actually go and watch it, but I'm not going to do it.
It has the great opening credit line, filmed in glorious black and white. No, the reason I mention it is that they spoof that sequence with Heston and Ben-Hur, where they have Skyler, their time traveling friend. The whole movie's about them going back in time to ancient Greece, where he's like this kind of Casper Milquetoast guy rowing, but as he's rowing, he's starting to build up his biceps. In fact, he builds them up so much that the entire rowing staff is on one side of the galley, and Skyler's on the other side rowing by himself. And then they move him to the other side to build up his other bicep. It's really a very funny movie, I have to say. And if you're a Three Stooges fan, I know it's not Curly, it's Curly Joe, but it is fun.
So you said it's Three Stooges versus Hercules?
The Three Stooges meet Hercules.
Meet Hercules. Okay, right. Yeah, it didn't make sense that they'd be fighting Hercules, but yes, I will check that out. That I'm very interested in seeing what that is. So minute six begins with a woman continuing her crossword puzzle and ends with the camera panning up to show us a large briefcase. So we ended things yesterday with, we have three of the hijackers already on the train. And, you know, we have Mr. Gray, who is played by Hector Elizondo. And I'm assuming you've met him also. You've probably met everyone. So,
you know, I haven't. In fact, I've reached out to Hector to see if he would come on my show with no luck yet. So I actually, looking at the cast of The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, I haven't met anybody.
You never met Mathau or Balsam?
Nope. I haven't met any of them. This is virgin territory for me. I certainly know who these people are. I'm looking down the cast to see if I have any connection whatsoever. Oh, you know what? I apologize. I was in my wife's beauty parlor one day, and sitting there having her hair done was Doris Roberts. And Doris Roberts plays the mayor's wife. So I do have a connection. And I hear, I actually, again, I'm correcting myself. Julius Harris, who plays Inspector Daniels, also was in a James Bond movie, Live and Let Die. And Julius, I gave a copy of my book to. He came to a science fiction convention. So I met Julius Harris, who played Teehee in Live and Let
Die. Live and Let Die.
I'm looking down the line. I think those are my only two connections to anybody.
You never met Jerry Stiller?
I never met Jerry Stiller, and I haven't met Ben Stiller.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, you've met two more people in this movie than I have, so that's already, that's already one up.
It's funny that one of the subway guards in the movie, his name is Jim Pelham. I thought that was kind of a funny coincidence.
Yes.
Let's see. Yeah, I think those are the two guys the man and woman I've met. So yeah, that pretty much covers it.
Okay. All right. That's fair. I mean, this is also the time when there are a lot of people who have uncredited roles. So I don't know if any of them were people who eventually had any type of career, but, their IMDb tries to give us some of these people.
It's amazing the research material we have at our fingertips today. When I first started researching the history of movies, I would go to the Motion Picture Academy in Beverly Hills, and they had files on literally every movie. But this is long before the internet. In fact, I didn't even know credits for the writers, producers, directors, and actors I'd been working with to set up interviews. I had to go to the library and learn what else they were in. So the amount of material just on IMDb today is so cool. We're instantly up to speed on almost everything.
That's right. That's and it's unbelievable the fact that IMDb is almost entirely done voluntarily. You know, obviously they do have a staff, but most of the information that's put there is put by people like us. You know, I've updated thousands upon thousands of entries on IMDb, with information.
Sure.
Yeah, it's great. So we ended things yesterday with Mr. Mattson giving a little bit of advice to our intrepid conductor.
Right. And, who is, let's see, the James Broderick plays the conductor at the beginning.
Yeah, no, this is played by
okay, let's figure this out.
It's Bud Carmody, Jerry Holland.
That's okay, so he's the motor man in training.
Yes.
Right. And that's right. He's being instructed by a more experienced conductor.
Exactly. Mr. Mattson.
Yeah. Got it.
Right, Mr. Mattson is played by Walter Jones. We talked a little about both of them last week. They don't really have that much information on them.
Right.
And so they're getting ready to show up at the at the next stop. The train is moving, and we have this woman who's doing a crossword puzzle, And she notices that Mr. Gray is staring at her, and he makes a very lewd gesture with his tongue towards her, and she just looks away and shakes her head, and he gets a kick out of that. He smiles. It's very funny because most of the movies that we've seen Hector Elizondo in over the last 40 years, he's played he doesn't play dark characters, but here he plays a very dark character.
He's pretty dark. He's pretty dark. I mean, I always think of his signature role being the concierge at the hotel in Pretty Woman. I mean,
And Pretty Woman,
I
exactly.
mean
But
he's yeah. He's
he was in every Gary Marshall movie. I
Oh
mean,
yeah.
he was his go-to guy,
No,
for any.
absolutely. He's despicable, and Mr. Gray is a definitely despicable guy. I'm trying to figure out his real name in the movie. Is he's from Detroit, I think.
He's a mafia guy.
Yeah, Joe Welcome, is that, I think that's his nickname in the at least I think at the end, I think.
They do talk about the fact that he was kicked out of the mafia. That's about
Right, but at the very end, when Jerry Stiller is briefing Walter on the backgrounds of the dead men, he mentions Hector Elizondo's character, and I think his nickname is Joe Welcome, unless that's Mr. Brown. I'm not 100. I think it might be Hector's character. Anyway, Hector's character is definitely playing dark.
right. And it doesn't it seems very much against what we're used to seeing. No. All right, so okay, now I can actually tell you what they call him. He's known as Joe Welcome, but that's his nickname.
Right.
His name is Giuseppe Benvenuto,
There you go.
whose
Okay.
alias is Joe Welcome.
Joe,
That's
welcome. There you go. I remember that vividly. Sure. And then I think Robert Shaw's name is Bernard Ryder, mercenary soldier. Yeah.
Right. In the novel, it's definitely Ryder, and in the 2009 remake, it's also Ryder.
Travolta.
Ryder
Yeah.
is Travolta's character.
Right. I have so forgotten the remake that I couldn't tell you who his fellow hijackers were in the 2009 remake. Maybe you can tell us.
Luis Guzman
Okay.
was one of them. He was the driver. It's been a really long time since I've seen it because I actually hate it. You know, see, I'm one of those people. I know I'm one of those people. If I really like a movie and then they remake it and it's subpar, so like I have no desire to see it again.
No,
You know,
I've had that feeling so many times. When I went to see Invaders from Mars, which is the Tobe Hooper remake of the classic, I was standing in line outside the Crest Theater in West LA, Westwood, and a guy comes out of the previous show and says, "Steve, don't go see this movie. Get out, go get your money back right now." I said, No, I paid my money." So I walk in the movie, I watch this atrocity, which is beyond awful. And then I come out of the theater and I see somebody waiting in line for the next performance. This is a guy I know. I said, "Don't see this movie." So there's an example of
and
negative.
did he listen to you or not?
Course not. Everybody goes in and sees it and they don't listen to people. Once you're there, you're there. I have to say that I've been watching movies for a long time. Over 70 years, or at least over 65 years. And in all that time, I've only walked out of four movies. I usually stay, sometimes suffer, but I usually stay for the whole movie.
Right. Okay. I have that rule also. When I start to watch a movie, I gotta keep watching it. Even it doesn't matter how bad it is, I gotta make it through it. And trust me, I've been through some really bad movies, but thankfully most of them I'm watching at home, so I can pause if I need to go, barf for a few minutes and then come back.
Well,
That type of thing.
the worst experience I ever had, I went to the Cinerama Dome in Hollywood for a sneak preview. Now, back in the day, Hollywood would have a sneak preview, and you didn't know what the movie was. It was potluck, so you'd get some real odd choices sometimes. I've seen some good movies that way. Soldier in the Rain with Steve McQueen and Jackie Gleason was a favorite, and I saw that as a sneak. But I went to the Dome. And the movie turned out to be a dubbed in English Russian circus movie with talking animals. It was
Oh my
so
God.
bad. It was so bad. Literally 5 minutes into the movie, the entire audience got up and left. The entire audience. No one stayed.
Yeah, that's something that you can obviously get upset about, the fact that they did that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, what were they thinking? I mean, it's enough. All right, it's a dubbed an English movie. Okay, I get that. Subtitles. But talking animals? Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
Yeah, seriously. I think the only movie that I've walked out of was Young Einstein with what was his name? Yahoo Serious or something like that. I have no idea. That was like in 89. I think that was the only time that I've actively walked out of a movie.
Okay.
It was just horrendous. Whatever. So yeah. Basically, Joe Welcome makes a lewd gesture at this woman, and she just like shakes it off, shakes her head, and he's happy with himself. And then the shot changes, and now we see Mr. Matson, who then says to Bud, he goes, "This is where I'm getting off. Hang in there, kid. You're doing fine." And he goes, "Yeah, I'll see ya." And then he starts to leave. The train stops. He starts to leave the train, and at this point, Mr. Brown like bumps into him pretty harshly, and he goes, "Hey, what's the rush, Chief? I ain't gonna leave without you." So, I've always loved the fact that that we get Mr. Brown in this movie played by Earl Hyman, who I obviously only know him from this movie and from Home Improvement. Those are the only places I know him from, but it's always fun seeing him.
And I guess my connection is my writing partner was one of the writer producers on Home Improvement. So there you go.
There you
There you go.
go. All right. And he never got you to go to the set and meet him, or you weren't partners at the time?
Well, we weren't partners at the time, and when he later became a major writer for Disney shows, I had the kids, so we went out to sh down to shows like the Wizards of Waverly Place and the Sweet Life of
Right.
Zack and Cody.
Have you ever met Tim Allen ever or not?
Yes, I actually Billy, my writing partner, and I were sitting in a coffee bean on Ventura Boulevard one day, and he walked right in. It was pretty funny. Billy said, and then Billy hadn't talked to him in like 3 or 4 years, so it was a fun moment.
Okay, very cool. And at this point, Mr. Brown looks around and gets ready, with what he's supposed to do, and we can see Mr. Gray through the window that he's in, that the two of them are in separate cabs, separate trains, and then Mr. Gray walks across the train, and sort of he pinches the woman that he had made a lewd gesture to earlier, and she gets very upset that he does that, but he doesn't care. And he just keeps moving. And
Is she the hooker or
I
is
believe so. Yes.
yeah, she plays the hooker.
I believe
She's
so.
they actually have a great deal of repartee. I don't know if even if it's appropriate to call it repartee. I'm looking up her name right now. Her name is Mary Gorman. Yeah, Mary Gorman has that great line. I won't repeat it in mixed company, but she does say anyway, never mind. Let's move on.
You can say it. Feel free. This is a we're gonna say the line later anyway, so you can say it now.
What does he call? He says a $5 a trick. Is it $5 a trick hooker? And she says a $5 wouldn't get you a good night kiss. It's pretty funny.
And that's a pretty clean line, so that's fine.
Okay, good, good, good.
You don't have to worry about that one.
And you know, it's
No,
funny.
just no. She says, "It's it goes." She says, "$20 wouldn't buy you a good night kiss." That's
Okay,
what it is.
yeah, there you go. I was underselling her.
Right. Well, no, it's because he makes the lines before because he gets into an argument with her. He keeps calling her a $20 a trick hooker.
Right, exactly.
We're going to get to that in almost an hour from now.
Okay. You know? Okay, good. Obviously, Mr. Ryder, in choosing his hijacking staff, probably didn't pay a lot of attention to Joe Welcome's resume, because I think if he had known out what a powder keg this guy was, I think he wouldn't have brought him on.
I think you were right. That definitely makes a lot of sense. And then Bud says over the loudspeaker, 33rd Street, next stop. Next stop, 33rd Street. And then we get a shot outside on the subway platform. We see feet shuffling back and forth. Someone trying to, it could be that they're trying to keep warm. It could be that they're a little nervous. You know, there's a lot of different answers of what it could be, because we don't know who this person is. You know, and then we see that there's this very tall briefcase right next to them. And that's about it.
Right, right.
And that's how this minute ends.
You have to give Joe Sargent a lot of credit for this movie. I mean, directing-wise, and, you know, Joe's done a lot of movies over the years, but nothing approaching the artistry of this movie and the pulsating quality of it, where there isn't a wasted moment in this whole movie. I mean, it has a pulsating beat. I think the listeners will agree with that. And combining that with David Shire's music, and it's just, you're on that train. You know, the cinema
completely
is so visceral here.
Yeah, it makes you wonder why he wasn't, why he didn't make other movies like this. You know, which, you know, you say, wow, that's you know, a near, if not a pure masterpiece. It's just unbelievable.
I know that you're going to be doing a minute with Steve Mitchell, my friend, and Steve is always talking.
Yeah, he's one of the last guests.
Yeah, Steve and I are always talking about great New York movies, and I think he considers The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 one of the greatest New York movies of all time on so many levels, particularly just the dialogue, the idiom, the sense of the streets and the subways. By the way, I was going to ask you, have you ever been on a New York subway?
Of course, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah. You know what it's like. It's definitely the way to go, as Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra sing on the Town. It's, New York, New York, a hell of a town. The Bronx is up and the Battery's down. The people move in a hole in the ground. I always thought that was a nice little signature theme.
Yeah. It's very true. All right. So, today's segment, every Monday, we have a segment called Mathau Monday, where my guests will give their top five Walter Mathau performances. I know we haven't seen him in the movie yet, but hopefully we'll catch him later this week. So why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, I will start with Lonely Are the Brave, which may not be a very familiar film to your listeners, but this is, Kirk Douglas has said that it's his favorite film, 1962. He plays a cowboy who's trying to find his friend in jail, and he finds that the only way he can see him is to actually get arrested, and he eventually escapes from prison, and he's chased by a county sheriff played by Walter Mathau, who plays Sheriff Maury Johnson. It is a wonderful performance. It is so wonderful. If you've never seen Lonely Are the Brave, just see it for Walter Matthau's performance. So that's my number five.
I think I have to see it again, because I saw it about 10 years ago and I wasn't impressed with it. So I think I need to check that out again.
Yes, particularly the Jerry Goldsmith score, very understated for Jerry. I would put Odd Couple as my number four. I mean, what a perfect role for Walter Matthau to play the kind of slovenly sports writer whose roommate, Jack Lemmon, is Mr. Neatness. And then here's a movie I saw recently for the first time, which is a delight. It's called A New Leaf. And basically, he plays someone who's married to Elaine May's character. And I think he spends most of the movie trying to kill her. She's kind of intolerable in certain ways, but she's a sweet lady. I don't know what really got him off on on trying to get rid of her, but it's a very funny performance. And of course, Elaine May is one of our great comedy directors.
I've seen it. It was pretty funny.
Sure. If you're asking me my five favorite Matthau performances, I'd have to consider Pelham. I mean, Pelham is one of my favorite movies of all time, and Matthau playing a character that is not in the original book. They obviously augmented the character, but Lieutenant Garber of the Transit Police is just perfectly realized character. And Matthau's sense of humor, the dark humor in this piece, and his gradual, I mean, the building of his character makes him great. And then I'd say the number one movie, Walter Matthau, The Sunshine Boys, where he plays opposite George Burns. And oh my God, a movie I saw recently for the first time, and seeing Matthau and Burns playing opposite one another is a great, great, great delight.
Yeah, again, it's another Neil Simon.
Right. Of course.
He did really well with Neil Simon stuff.
I was at a friend's backyard hanging out with Richard Benjamin, who's also in the Sunshine Boys. And of course, we know Richard Benjamin from Goodbye Columbus, Catch 22, and also directed, for me, one of the great comedies of the 1980s, which is My Favorite Year, which is just really a lot of fun. We were trying to get Richard to come on board a project of ours as a director, but he's pretty much retired.
All right, so every day we also have another segment, which is a game, and the game is called Name That Remake. Okay, so
we have they're all so bad.
We have to, yes. But you might still know the original. That you have to know the title. That's what you have to tell me. I'm gonna tell you what year the original came out, what year the remake came out, and I will give you a one sentence synopsis of the plot. And you have to try and tell me what movie it is. You know, okay. I think you'd be pretty good with this.
Okay,
go ahead. Again, it's completely random because I don't know what movie you will be getting, and so I will spin the wheel and let's see what movie we get. Let the wheel go round and round and round and round and round, and okay, we have one. We definitely have one. All right, you should know this one. You know, this I know that you've seen the original of this movie for sure. You know, the question is whether you've seen the remake. It's quite possible. Okay, so the original movie came out in 1963, and the remake came out in 1996. Okay, and it is about a chemistry teacher who is able to, he discovers
about
this
the
magic
absent-minded, I know, we were talking about the nutty professor.
We are talking about the nutty professor. Excellent.
Okay.
You see? Yeah. Now, do you think the Eddie Murphy version is anywhere close to being as interesting or as good as the Jerry Lewis one or not?
I recall laughing a little bit. I think, comedy in the 90s is not like comedy in the 60s. They don't necessarily control themselves much. As I recall, there were a lot of fart jokes.
Yes.
Yeah. It's kind of slumming a little bit, but I'm a fan of Eddie Murphy. I think that was probably a pretty good idea.
Right. Okay. Excellent. All right. So, Steve, why don't you tell people where they can find you?
Hopefully they're not going to come kill me since we're dealing with thrillers. My podcast is called Stephen J. Rubin Saturday Night at the Movies, and that's J-A-Y spelled out. We're on all the main platforms, Apple, Spotify, Podbean. I also have a YouTube channel, also Stephen J. Rubin Saturday Night at the Movies. I also have a second podcast called Tales from Hollywood Land, which you can Google. I co-host it with Julian Schlossberg and Arthur E. Friedman, two fellow producers. I have a Facebook page, Stephen J. Rubin, again, J-A-Y. I have the James Bond Movie Encyclopedia page as well. I'm on LinkedIn, Stephen J. Rubin again. I'm on X. I'm on Instagram.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you feel like sending me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow,
Gesundheit.